Have you ever looked at your life, maybe right after someone just casually insulted your clothes or your home or your background, and you just felt this sudden burning desperation to completely reinvent yourself?
Oh man, yeah.
Like to just scrub away everything about where you came from, strictly to prove to that one specific person that you are worthy of their attention.
Right. It's this incredibly raw, often super embarrassing human impulse.
It really is. We spend immense amounts of energy trying to curate a new identity just to escape the vulnerability of our original one.
Yeah, and that desire drives so much of modern ambition. We see it in the way people curate their social media, or the way they change their accents, or frankly, the way they go into massive debt just to acquire the aesthetic markers of success. The instinct to engineer a flawless, unassailable version of yourself is universal. And it usually stems from a moment of profound humiliation.
And that universal impulse is really the beating heart of our subject today. Welcome to our companion conversation. Today, we are exploring the 1867 text of Charles Dickens's Great Expectations.
We are indeed.
We're looking closely at the Clair Narratio audiobook edition. And look, if you have this preconceived notion that Victorian literature is just some dusty, moralizing slog to sleep through, you need to discard that immediately.
Oh, totally. Throw that idea right out the window.
Because this book operates much closer to a psychological thriller.
It really does. It's this phenomenal examination of ambition, crushing guilt, and just the toxic, corrosive nature of tying your fundamental self-worth to money and status. Charles Dickens was writing this novel for his own weekly magazine all year round back in the early 1860s, and he actually needed a massive hit to boost some sagging circulation
You're
numbers.
right, so the stakes were high for him personally.
Very high. So he engineered a story with deliberate, relentless pacing. It was meant to keep readers hanging on every single installment.
Which is why it moves the way it does.
Yeah. He weaves this narrative about what happens when we try to construct our own identities from the outside in, and the collateral damage we end up inflicting on the people who actually love us in the process.
So, to really grasp the stakes for the protagonist, an orphan boy named Pip, you have to understand the physical and psychological landscape he is born into.
Right. Setting the scene is crucial here.
Dickens builds a Victorian world that is sharply, violently divided. On one side, you have the bustling, dirty, chaotic metropolis of London, which represents wealth and the
Your
future.
big city.
And on the other side, you have the bleak, freezing marsh country down by the river in Kent, within 20 miles of the sea.
And that marsh country is just so oppressive.
It really is. Dickens describes young Pip as a small bundle of shivers, growing afraid of it all and beginning to cry. The landscape itself just feels actively hostile to his existence.
Hostile and distinctly carceral.
Carceral, right, because of the hulks.
Right. The marshes are totally dominated by the presence of the hulks. And for anyone unfamiliar with the 19th century British penal system, the hulks were decommissioned naval
They
ships.
stripped them down, right?
Yeah, stripped of their masts and rigging and used as floating prisons, they were moored right out in the mudflats, and they just loom over the horizon of Pip's childhood like this constant brooding threat.
Which sounds terrifying for a kid.
Oh, they were notoriously brutal, disease-ridden places where convicts were held before being transported to penal colonies overseas. And from the very first pages, the text explicitly links the reality of poverty and the working class with the inevitability of criminality.
Right, because Pip is a blacksmith's boy. He's an orphan, and he's basically treated by the adults in his life like a criminal just for existing.
Yeah, the psychological conditioning he undergoes is terrifying.
It is. His sister, Mrs. Joe, who is raising him, quote unquote, by hand.
Which is just a polite Victorian euphemism for beating him relentlessly with a wax-ended cane she calls tickler.
Which is so dark. She constantly tells him he's naturally vicious. At one point, Pip merely asks her what the hulks are, and she just snaps at him that people are put there because they murder and rob, and that they always begin by asking questions.
She literally turns a child's natural curiosity into a precursor for a life of crime.
Which is wild.
And the tragedy is how quickly Pip internalizes that condemnation. He reflects later that he felt fearfully sensible, that the hulks were handy for him, and that he was clearly on his way there.
He just assumes he's bad.
Yeah, Dickens is establishing right away that this is not a fairy tale. It's a brutal reality where class and morality are entirely conflated. A poor boy is inherently guilty, like a problem to be solved or contained.
While a wealthy gentleman is just instantly respected and presumed innocent, so Pip is primed to feel like a criminal in his own home. But that psychological conditioning is put to the ultimate test when the abstract idea of a criminal becomes very, very real.
Oh, the graveyard scene.
Yes. Pip is in the desolate churchyard looking at the tombstones of his parents and his five dead infant brothers, which, again, bleak when he has a terrifying encounter with an escaped convict named Magwitch.
And Magwitch has a great iron forged onto his leg, broken shoes.
And he grabs Pip, turns him upside down, and threatens to cut his throat and tear out his heart and liver if the boy doesn't rip him a file and some whittles.
Whittles meaning food.
Right. Food.
The visceral terror of that scene is unmatched. Pip complies out of sheer mortal fear, but Dickens also weaves in this strange, quiet thread of pity.
How so?
Well, Pip steals a pork pie and a file from his own home from his brother-in-law Joe's forge to keep this man alive. And in doing so, he crosses a line. He cements his internal belief that he is, in fact, the criminal his sister always claimed he was.
That guilt forms the foundational bedrock of his character. Everything he does from that moment on is an attempt to outrun the taint of the marshes and the memory of that escaped convict.
Exactly. Well, wait. Actually, I'd argue the true infection of shame, the thing that makes him want to completely eradicate his own identity, doesn't happen in the graveyard.
Oh, where do you think it happens?
Satis House.
Ah, yes.
Satis House.
Right. This is the rotting, frozen-in-time mansion owned by Miss Havisham. She's this wealthy woman who was jilted at the altar decades ago. She never took off her wedding dress.
Never took it off. Never cleared the rotting wedding feast from her table. And she brings Pip there to play cards with her adopted daughter, Estella.
And Estella is stunningly beautiful, but she has been systematically trained by Miss Havisham to be cruel.
So cruel.
Huh.
She mocks Pip for calling the knaves jacks when playing cards. She points out his coarse hands and his thick boots with utter disgust.
Which just ruins him.
It does. Satis House operates like a funhouse mirror that permanently distorts Pip's entire worldview. Before crossing that threshold, he actually looked forward to being apprenticed to Joe at the forge.
Right. He respected Joe's honest labor.
But after Satis House, he looks at his own hands, his boots, the soot of the forge, and even Joe himself, and feels nothing but profound, agonizing shame.
He wants to be an uncommon gentleman to win Estella's approval. He just wants to rip up his roots.
Yeah.
I have to challenge the conventional reading of Satis House here, though. We always talk about Miss Havisham's environment as a tragic trauma response, you know, the architectural equivalent of a nervous breakdown.
Right. But isn't it also a spectacular display of weaponized privilege? I mean, a poor person who is heartbroken cannot afford to stop the clocks, board up the windows, let a massive mansion rot into the ground, and just sit in a decaying wedding dress for 20 years.
They'd starve to death.
Right. They would starve. Miss Havisham's grief is entirely funded and insulated by her immense unearned wealth.
That is a crucial distinction. And honestly, Dickens uses it to highlight the pathology of the upper class. Money acts as this insulator that allows her trauma to fester and mutate into something malevolent.
It really is malevolent.
She refuses to process her pain, and instead, she weaponizes it. She brings up Estella in this darkness, explicitly teaching her to be an enemy to daylight, to just break men's hearts.
She treats Estella not as a human being, but as an instrument of revenge.
Yeah. Satis House represents the emotional death that comes from living in the past, funded by a class system that allows the rich to impose their madness on everyone else. And Pip sees this madness, and because of the wealth attached to it, he mistakes it for superiority. Wow, yeah. He assumes that becoming part of that world will fix his internal sense of inadequacy. And he gets his chance when a formidable, intimidating London lawyer named Mr. Jaggers arrives at the village inn.
Jaggers is such a great character.
He announces that Pip has great expectations. He is to be removed from his current common sphere of life and brought up as a gentleman in London, funded by a secret benefactor with a bottomless wallet.
And Pip immediately, and rather arrogantly, assumes the benefactor must be Miss Havisham, grooming him to eventually marry Estella.
Which is quite the leap.
It is. The irony of his departure is palpable. He practically runs away from the forge, he moves to London, shares rooms at Barnard's Inn with his new friend Herbert Pocket, and acquires all the aesthetic markers of wealth.
The tailored suits, the clubs.
Right. He joins an exclusive dining club called the Finches of the Grove. He runs up massive debts, and he becomes, honestly, a complete snob. He actively avoids Joe because Joe is too common. He achieves his reinvention, but it's entirely hollow.
And it is hollow because the adult world he is entering is built on staggering hypocrisy. And I think this is where modern audiences often miss out on one of the greatest joys of the book.
The humor.
Yes. people brace themselves for dreary Victorian misery, and they miss the fact that Dickens is brilliantly, darkly hilarious. The comedy in this book is incredibly sharp, and it's used specifically to expose the superficiality of the class system Pip is so desperate to join.
Oh, the humor is an essential counterweight to the tragedy. I mean, think about the Christmas dinner scene early in the novel.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Pip is sitting at the table, completely terrified that his theft of the poor pie for the convict is about to be discovered. Meanwhile, the adults are subjecting him to this relentless, pseudo-moralistic bullying over dinner.
You have Uncle Pumblechook holding forth on what he calls the moral of pork.
We really should explain Pumblechook, because his title alone is a joke.
Go ahead.
He's a corn chandler, which, for anyone not up on their 19th century agricultural trade, basically means he's a grain and seed merchant.
Yeah.
He sells birdseed and flour, but he acts like he's part of the landed aristocracy. At dinner, he asks Pip to consider what would have happened if he'd been born a pig.
It's so unhinged.
He says, "You would have been disposed of for so many shillings according to the market price of the article, and the butcher would have shed your blood and had your life." It is this utterly absurd theatrical guilt trip over a piece of meat delivered to a terrified child.
And right next to him is Mr. Wopsle, the parish clerk with a Roman nose and a booming voice, who punishes the amens at church and treats every minor conversation like a Shakespearean monologue.
Yep.
Wopsle jumps in to agree with Pumblechook, declaring that what is detestable in a pig is even more detestable in a boy.
The adults are so self-important, so ridiculous in their grandiosity, that the scene reads like a sketch comedy routine. But Dickens is showing us how adult society constantly projects its own greed and cruelty onto the most vulnerable people in the room.
And the true venom behind that comedy is revealed in how quickly these ridiculous characters change their tune the second money enters the equation.
Oh, the pivot is amazing.
Mr. Pumblechook treats Pip like garbage when he is a poor apprentice. He literally pushes him around. But the moment Pip gets his great expectations, Pumblechook suddenly claims to be the founder of Pip's fortunes.
He constantly asks to shake Pip's hand and calls him his earliest patron. He just performs submission to the money.
The scene with Mr. Treb the tailor is the masterclass in this specific social satire, though.
Oh, absolutely. When Pip goes into town to buy his first set of gentleman's clothes, Mr. Treb is busy eating his breakfast. He is completely dismissive.
Doesn't even want to look at him.
Right. But when Pip casually mentions he is coming to a handsome property and drops some gold guineas on the counter, a complete physical transformation comes over the tailor. He forgets his food, wipes his fingers, and starts bowing and scraping.
And the most revealing part is how Trab violently turns on his own sweeping boy.
Yeah, that part is so dark.
Trab's boy is just doing his job, sweeping the floor, and Trab threatens to knock his head off purely to show his extreme deference to Pip. Trab commands the boy to fetch fabrics, calling him a vagabond and a young scoundrel.
He has to demean someone lower on the social ladder just to prove his respect for Pip's new wealth.
Exactly. It exposes how fragile the Victorian class system actually is. It has nothing to do with nobility or character. It is entirely performative, based strictly on the presence of ready money.
And Dickens drives that point home with the concept of portable property. This is embodied by Mr. Jagger's clerk, Wemmick.
I love Wemmick.
Wemmick is obsessed with movable wealth. He collects rings, tie pins, and watches from the desperate criminals who are sentenced to hang at Newgate Prison.
He wears them as a twisted kind of investment portfolio.
He explicitly tells Pip, "My guiding star always is, get hold of portable property."
Wemmick literally strips the dead to fund his life. He treats human tragedy as a source of physical, movable wealth. The book constantly asks you to evaluate what a person's true value is. Is it the portable property they can acquire? The gold watches, the rings, the tailored suits?
Right, because Pip's entire life in London is an exercise in accumulating portable property to prove his worth.
And that accumulation requires him to discard the people who possess actual intrinsic human worth. We see the tragedy of the snobbery culminate in the scene where Joe Gargery visits Pip in London.
Which is just excruciating to read.
Joe is a blacksmith. He possesses no portable property. He lives in a burnt apron. But his capacity for unconditional love is immense. When he comes to Barnard's Inn to see Pip, the collision of their two worlds is physically painful to witness.
The details of that scene are just heartbreaking. Joe has dressed up in his Sunday clothes out of respect for Pip's new station, but the clothes are stiff and completely unnatural on him.
His collar is so high it makes his hair stand up.
Yeah, and he doesn't know what to do with his hat, so he keeps awkwardly standing it on the mantelpiece, and it keeps falling off. Every time it falls, it acts as a physical punctuation mark on the extreme awkwardness between them.
Pip is embarrassed by him. He is irritated by Joe's table manners, by his coughs, by the clumsy way he holds his fork.
But Joe is uneducated, not stupid. He is incredibly emotionally intelligent. He senses Pip's irritation completely. He knows he is unwanted.
Yeah.
The emotional climax of this tension is Joe's parting speech. He stops calling Pip by his formal new title, Sir, and reverts to Pip, dear old chap.
He says, I'm wrong in these clothes. I'm wrong out of the forge, the kitchen, or off the meshes. You won't find half so much fault in me if you think of me in my forge dress with my hammer in my hand or even my pipe.
And then he touches Pip gently on the forehead and leaves.
Joe realizes that their worlds are now incompatible, and he accepts the division with complete dignity. He refuses to force his presence on a boy who is ashamed of him.
And Joe's dignity really highlights the absolute superficiality of Pip's new life. Pip is living entirely for an imagined future, for these grand expectations, and in doing so, he's destroying his present reality.
He becomes terrified of exposure.
He is deeply in debt, lacking any real practical skills, spending his days going to look about him in the city, which is just a polite fiction for doing absolutely nothing.
All of which sets the stage for the devastating twist.
Oh, the twist is so good.
On a dark, stormy night, years later, Pip is sitting alone in his expensive apartment. He hears footsteps on the stairs. A rough, weathered man with long, iron-gray hair comes into the room.
It's the convict from the graveyard.
Magwitch has returned from the penal colonies of New South Wales, and as the storm rages outside, Magwitch reveals that he's the secret benefactor.
The psychological shock of this moment cannot be overstated. Magwitch made a fortune sheep farming in Australia, and he secretly poured every single penny into making Pip a gentleman.
He did it partly out of gratitude for that stolen pork pie, but mostly out of a twisted desire to own a gentleman of his own.
Miss Havisham had absolutely nothing to do with it. Pip realizes in an instant that his entire refined upper-class life is funded by the very criminality and poverty he thought he had escaped.
It's the ultimate rug pull. Pip spent his entire life running from the stain of the marshes, trying to wash off the dirt of the forge to become something pristine, only to find out that the wealth he worshipped was, in the eyes of his society, deeply contaminated.
And look at Magwitch's motivation here. We talked about Miss Havisham weaponizing her wealth to create Estella. Mm-hmm. Magwitch does the exact same thing to Pip, just from the opposite end of the social spectrum.
Magwitch treats Pip as a proxy to strike back at the society that discarded him.
Right. We learn later that Magwitch's former partner in crime, a man named Compeyson, received a much lighter sentence at their trial simply because Compeyson looked and spoke like a gentleman.
Oh, right.
Magwitch, who was rough and poor, was given the maximum penalty. The justice system judged them entirely on aesthetics. So Magwitch decides to buy his own gentleman to prove he can manipulate the system too.
He literally thinks to himself, I'm making a better gentleman nor ever you'll be.
True love, as modeled by Joe, doesn't demand a transformation. But Magwitch and Miss Havisham both view people as projects to be optimized for their own vindication.
And experiencing this text on a page is powerful, but taking it in as an audiobook brings an entirely different dimension to the story. When you listen to the Clara Naratio edition, the strict class boundaries we've been talking about become immediate and undeniable.
The voices do so much heavy lifting.
Dickens spells the dialogue phonetically to force the reader to hear the accents, and a skilled narrator brings that to life in a way the eye alone might gloss over.
Yeah, the dialects are basically artifacts of the character's social standing and their inner moral compasses. When you hear Magwitch's rough, guttural speech talking about whittles and calling Pip dear boy, it is a visceral shock against the sharp, cross-examining, almost surgical precision of Mr. Jaggers.
Jaggers speaks in hypothetical legalities, never committing to a single fact, biting his forefinger as he stares you down.
You hear the performative, booming theatricality of Pumblechook compared to the quiet, dignified clarity of Joe, who constantly inserts, which I mean ordeer, as he struggles to articulate complex emotions with a limited vocabulary.
When Pip changes his speech to match the London gentleman, you literally hear the loss of his connection to the marshes. You hear the alienation creeping into his voice.
It makes this 150-year-old text feel alarmingly relevant to you today.
It really does. We might not have status house or floating prison ships on the horizon, but look at Pip's journey in the context of modern hustle culture.
Oh, it's 100% the same thing.
He gets the extreme makeover. He acquires the luxury apartment and the tailored suits. He projects this image of effortless superiority to the world.
But the reality behind that curated aesthetic is chronic anxiety and crushing debt. He is terrified of being exposed as an imposter because his entire identity is built on a foundation he doesn't control or understand.
Dickens is showing us exactly what happens when you try to program a human being, like a piece of software, to fulfill someone else's expectations. It always crashes, and it usually takes you down with it.
Yeah. The pursuit of these great expectations was a pursuit of a phantom built entirely on suffering, exploitation, and the rejection of authentic love. The common life Pip ran from the life of the forge, of Joe's honest labor, was the only life that possessed actual integrity.
And that leads to a really compelling reevaluation of the antagonists. We look at Miss Havisham and Magwitch as the architects of Pip's misery, manipulating him with their wealth.
But if you step back, you have to ask, are they the true villains, or are they just the most traumatized victims of Victorian capitalism?
Right, because Miss Havisham was preyed upon by a grifter who exploited her wealth and gender.
And Magwitch was brutalized by a penal system that criminalized his poverty while letting the wealthy go free. They are both profoundly broken by a system that values portable property over human life, and they simply pass that trauma down to Pip and Estella.
That is the thought I want to leave you with. If you strip away the tailored suits, the curated aesthetic, and the desperate need to impress people who look down on you, what is actually left?
It's a heavy question.
Are the systems we use to measure our own worth turning us into victims, or are they turning us into villains? It is a question that requires deep reflection, and there is no better place to explore it than by returning to the text itself.
Definitely.
We invite you to head back to the Clarinor Oshio audiobook to experience the grit, the dark humor, and the profound heartbreak of Dickens's masterpiece for yourself. Hear the voices, feel the cold of the marshes, and witness the true cost of reinvention. Until next time, keep listening.